Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This gorgeous magazine is highly collectible and is delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future. I'm starting to sound like the Micro Machines guys. Maybe I should slow down a little bit.
Nah, keep going.
I'm just so excited. I'm so excited.
Leave it all in. Leave it all in.
I'm leaving all this in. Let's see. Where did I leave off? Genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, Mr. Wampler and yours truly. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you'll need to subscribe. And to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you do that and you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you're going to save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan 25% off of your subscription.
Now, with all of that said, let's get on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Scott Wampler.
And we are your hosts. We have a doozy for you today, folks. We are tackling the Bachman Books collection comprised of Rage, The Long Walk, Roadwork, and The Running Man. So you're getting 4 titles for the price of one this episode. Joining us is a director who you may know from his work on Kick-Ass 2, Truth or Dare, or the recent highly entertaining bloodbath-filled reimagining of Fantasy Island. He has a new flick coming to theaters March 8th called Imaginary, which I haven't seen yet, but I think it's a heartwarming tale of children cuddling with teddy bears and having tea parties with their imaginary friends. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's what it's about. But we'll talk to him about this surely family-friendly film and then dive into the Bachman books. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jeff Wadlow to the KingCast stage.
Thank you so much, Eric and Scott. I am thrilled to be here, excited to talk about the Bachman books and to talk about Imaginary, which you are correct, is the feel-good family movie of the spring.
Great. Yeah, I mean, I pictured like kind of a Little Princess vibe or something.
Right? Exactly. Yes. It stars Ryan Reynolds and Secret Steve Garden. Carell, and it was directed by John Krasinski. I'm kidding. Wrong movie. That's If. Our movie is terrifying and will ruin your childhood.
Oh, yes. I was thinking of Toy Story this whole time. I really fucked this up. Yeah. Blumhouse has not been shy about this movie. You know, there's a lot of hype around this movie. You know, they seem very, we haven't seen it yet, but they seem very confident in it. I would find it hard to believe that anyone listening to this show has avoided any of the, you know, trailers or marketing or whatever. You know, we run on Fangoria. We just ran an interview with your teddy bear the other day, I saw, which was quite a thing to read, I will point out. But for anyone who's listening to this who isn't aware of Imaginary or what it's about, can you give us the pitch?
Yeah, Imaginary is the story of a woman who moves back into her childhood home with a blended family and quickly discovers that her imaginary friend is still in the house. And he's taking an interest in her youngest stepdaughter. And he might not be real happy with her for leaving.
Okay, so the imaginary friend in this scenario is invisible, or is it the bear?
Well, it's the bear.
Okay, cool.
He's
so
imagining
the bear
that,
is living in the house when they
well,
show
no,
up?
Well, no, he's, you know, he's imagining that the bear has a personality and has a voice, but it's very much a movie about creativity and imagination. So I'm very, very much telling the story through a subjective lens. So there's a lot of questions about what is real and what is not.
I see. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, I have to applaud you for this approach just, off the cuff here, because when I was a kid, I'd never had that like drop dead Fred imaginary friend that was like the invisible person, you know, who only I could see. That was never my experience. I always talked through like my Snoopy doll and like stuffed Snoopy or something. Right. And so when I was like a little kid, Snoopy was my imaginary friend. Not, I didn't go, oh, this is the Snoopy from the cartoons, but it was just a thing that I could sit across from me and have like, kid conversations with or whatever.
I was certainly more in that kind of kid when it came to imaginary friends. Like, I didn't have an invisible imaginary friend named, you know, like Stefan, who,
who was giving you all the best, the hottest clubs in New York.
Yeah, right? No, my imaginary friends were my G.I. Joes and my Transformers and He-Man. And I very much kind of lived in a world that I created in my own mind. And so really it's much more a movie about creativity and imagination, because I think that speaks to everyone's childhood, not just the people who had an invisible buddy.
I understand that you played through your toys like G.I. Joes and such, but like Eric, Eric had a Snoopy. I had like a Gizmo from Gremlins.
Mm. Oh yes.
And I also had a blanket named Gigi that, which I cannot believe I just admitted on air.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. At least I know what the sequel's about.
Yeah.
We need some KingCast fan art now of Wampler with his Gigi.
Yeah. So you had like, you know, your toys, but did you have like a personal item, like a stuffed thing that like had a name?
My little sister had a blanket called Gaki, so I can certainly relate to your story through her.
That's not
experience.
A yes or no. Did you have...
I really didn't have like a singular thing that I had named in that sense. It was really much more about the world I think I was creating. And again, when you see the movie, you'll understand more what I'm talking about. It's not really just about like this one thing in the house. There's a lot more going on.
Right on.
I can tell you that at least in the far reaches of Austin, Texas, like the trailer has been like pretty much nonstop running before everything that I've seen. And it's working, because sometimes that can really go against the movie. Like Argyle, for instance, was a trailer that single fucking trailer ran for like 8 months solid.
Oh my God.
It was before every goddamn movie, horror, kids movie, doesn't matter. It was playing there. And that got people going, I just don't even want to see this fucking thing when it comes out. But imaginary, every time I've seen the trailer play, like there's that little like whisper, like, oh, we should see that. And Kel's, my girlfriend, is like chomping at the bit. Like she was even asking like, oh, is it this week? Is it this week that it's out? I'm just like, no, you got to wait another week.
That don't worry. So my heart swell with joy. Thank you so much. I can't tell you how happy I am to hear that.
And since we all know anecdotal experience trumps any sort of real statistics, know that means you're going to make $100 million this week.
Listen, I hope it's true in this one instance. Yeah, no, I mean, the marketing team has done an incredible job of getting the word out there. And I think the movie supports the marketing. I mean, we gave them the material. And it's always nice when you've made a movie that the marketing team understands. A couple times in my career, I've made movies where they try to market it as something else. And that's really disheartening, because even if they're getting the word out, people are going to come into the theater with expectations that aren't going to be met. Right. And then ultimately they're disappointed and they say they didn't like the movie. But the truth is, it's not that the movie had a problem. It's that they were promised something different before they walked through the door.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm to understand that you shot this film in New Orleans. And I'm wondering, I know what I go to New Orleans for typically. And I'm trying to understand. I know what a gigantic endeavor making a film is. How do you balance being in New Orleans while you're directing a movie with not really engaging with New Orleans as many people engage with New Orleans, which is to say like going out and drinking hand grenades on Bourbon Street.
I'm going to one up you, because not only did I live in New Orleans making this movie, I lived in the French Quarter.
Oh, Jesus.
Making this movie. I rented this apartment on this like pedestrian alley next to the Louisiana Supreme Court building, which is actually in the middle of the French Quarter. Mm. And it was this cool old apartment that used to be a fencing academy like 150 years ago or something crazy like that. You could actually see the marks on the walls from the sabers, really? The foils, whatever.
From the really bad fencers.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, why?
It was a blind fencing academy. They didn't tell them.
Why does Anton keep trying to stab the brick wall?
Yeah.
No, it was incredible experience. I had such a wonderful time. The crews there are fantastic. The facilities we shot in were outstanding. And during the limited time off I had, I got to drink hand grenades in the French Quarter. So
fair enough. Did you come away from this experience in New Orleans with a favorite restaurant which is another thing the city is known for.
There's so many good ones.
It's fucking hard to pin one down. But like,
I actually kept a like a running list in my phone of every restaurant that someone would recommend to make sure I would go check it out. And I think I got all of them. So it's really a long list. And I tried not to ever go to the same restaurant twice, believe it
or not. Right.
I mean, look, the old standby is like Commander's Palace. The food is fantastic there.
I don't think we went there when we were last in New Orleans, did we?
You got to get I think it's called the milk punch drink. Ooh, so good.
I don't remember the names of any of those places.
We went to Mother's, of course, the po' boy.
Yes.
Shop. Yep,
I went there.
Willie Mae's chicken.
Oh, that was good.
Didn't go there.
The fried chicken place. That's like you have to take a little. You have to have a car and kind of go a little bit out of the city a bit.
Got it.
It's weird. It's one of those restaurants that's in like a house in another, like a suburban, it was a little bit rundown, but a little rundown neighborhood. And there's just a house there that happens to be like the best fried chicken that's ever been made by mankind. So,
wow.
What's it called again?
It was Willie Mae's.
Isn't it Willie Mae's like Bourbon Shack or something though? Because I remember we showed up and I was like, God, I got to get a drink. And they were like, we don't serve alcohol here. And I was like, there's the name of an alcohol in the name of this place. Yes. Like, what?
Yeah. I think that was some long like stand. There was something they used to serve alcohol and I guess they don't anymore, but they kept the name or they named one of the buildings the Bourbon Shack and the other one was the, you know, where the food was. I don't know. But I do remember that moment. You're like, what the fuck? This is the one place in New Orleans that doesn't serve liquor and I need it. And then we went to that one place that the one that I can never remember is the one that we found while we were just sitting there at Lowry's while you were having a Bloody Mary to kind of.
Oh, yeah, a little hair of
the dog, right?
Yeah, and it was right next to St. Patrick's, best French onion soup I've ever had. But let's get back to our guest, Mr. Jeff Wadlow.
Yes.
McNary.
Yeah, his eyes have glazed over going,
yeah, I'm
guys,
sorry,
we get Jeff. It. There's good food in New Orleans.
Yeah, we were. Yeah.
I was enjoying the trip down memory lane because there's quite a bit of good food in New Orleans.
Yeah.
How gnarly does this movie get?
Yeah.
Violent? No?
I mean, look, it's PG-13, so obviously are some lines we are not crossing.
Yes.
There is a lot of dread and terror in the film, I believe, but I would not describe it as gory.
I think you can make a solid PG-13 horror movie and still have it scary. You know, I don't necessarily think gore equates to scary. Like, I don't think that at all. So, but I was curious because I was just curious if we're going to get to see this bear fucking, you know, gut somebody or something.
Let's put it this way. The bear guts someone. It's not exactly on camera, but there is someone gets it and it's not pleasant.
Very well. Well, we're very much looking forward to seeing this movie. I would like to lob more questions at you about it, but we have quite a bit of material to get through over the course of the show, and so I'd like to move this on now to a question that we ask all of our guests, which is what is your Stephen King origin story? When did you first become aware of our show's namesake?
You know, it's funny, it's hard to isolate a moment. It's more of a feeling, right? I was born in 1976, so, you know, kind of in the early 80s, I mean, just everyone was talking about King. Like, everyone was reading his books. You know, you'd be hard-pressed to walk down a beach anywhere in the United States in the summertime and not see someone reading a Stephen King book. Right. So it was just, he was so kind of steeped in all the pop culture around us, and I was just taking it all in like a sponge. So I have memories of, like, you know, seeing people read Cujo and Christine and talking about It and The Shining, of course. I mean, those are probably the four titles that I was first exposed to. Right. And I don't know if that has to do with, forgive me, I am not the King aficionado that obviously you two gentlemen are, but I don't know if it has something to do with when those books were released, that they were kind of released in that time period, or if it has more to do with just the sort of the singular concepts behind those books that they really just kind of cut through.
Or the movies.
Yeah. The movies too. But I mean, it just like, it feel like he had a real grip on pop culture. I mean, he always does, but more so at that point than probably before, maybe even a few years later,
right,
when all the copycats started to show up.
Did either of your parents read Stephen King?
Yeah, everyone read it. I mean, it was just, I don't know anyone who didn't read Stephen King, to be completely honest with you. I mean, it was ubiquitous. Like, I remember my brother was reading. In fact, the reason why I picked the Bachman books is I remember stealing it off my brother's bookshelf. Everyone was reading it. It in particular was one that I think really just gripped everyone around me.
Right.
And there was a lot of talk about it at the time.
One fun fact I learned about you while digging into your business before we did this show is that you are the nephew of Katie Couric.
This is true.
Did she read Stephen King?
I'm sure
you said
she
everyone
did.
In your family was reading.
Yeah,
Stephen
I'm
King.
Sure she did. Look, listen, I've never had a conversation with Katie Couric about like Cujo. Like I didn't say, hey, neither. Katie, did you read Cujo? But she is an avid reader and a consumer of pop culture. So I'm guessing she must have read.
Does she like podcasts?
Yeah, I was going to say, you might not have had that conversation with her. But if Katie Couric wants to come on here and talk about Cujo, please put in a good word.
Listen,
for
she
us.
She loves to talk to everyone about everything. So I bet she'd be thrilled.
Mark, this is the moment we go, well, I guess we're going to reach out to Katie Couric.
Wait, hold on. Is this the point of this whole podcast? Is you're just using me to get to Katie Couric to get her on KingCast?
Oh, yeah. We're not even recording right now.
Delightful.
Was the Bachman books the first King related thing that you read that you stole off of your brother's nightstand? Or was this like.
Yeah. I mean, I remember sort of flirting with Cujo and Christine and kind of being a weenie about it and getting a little too like nervous. And I think the Bachman books, I think I was drawn to the cover. Like it had this really red cover.
Yep.
And I think because it was like,
it's got the skulls on it.
Secret that it was written by Stephen King, but it wasn't on the book. Or at least in big letters. I think that was kind of interesting to me and had me leaning in. And I think also because it was just really, the story seemed to be not quite so classic kind of gothic horror stories in the sense of like a killer dog.
Right.
Like it was more sort of horror adjacent, a little more sci-fi that I think I was sort of drawn to it too. Mm. I mean, let me be clear. I was a bit of a scaredy cat when I was a kid. Uh-huh. I saw Poltergeist and it really freaked me out. I just saw it at the wrong point in my life.
It's a scary fucking movie.
Yeah.
How old were you?
Let's see. I was, like I said, born in 76. I think that movie came out in 82, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was like 6.5 years old when I saw it in theaters, and it definitely messed me up. And so I think
you were Carol Ann's age. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I had terrible nightmares afterwards. It's funny that I make scary movies now. but so I think I was drawn to the Bachman books because they weren't like such overt horror.
Hmm. Well, that's something that's really interesting about this, the whole Bachman persona is that, you know, I started reading King probably the late 80s. I was born in 81 and I was reading too young, but I was still, you know, reading in like, you know, the late 80s. And so by then the whole Bachman persona had already been figured out and he'd embraced it and he'd published the Bachman books with his name on them going, yep, these are the four early novels by Stephen King, I think is what's emblazoned on the cover. Right. Mm-hmm. But even then there was like the sense of like, these are the dangerous ones, right? These are the ones that he didn't publish under his own name. Why didn't he do that? In the sense at the time, at least for me, wasn't because he was embarrassed by them or didn't think they were worthy of his name. It was just like, oh my God, these are too extreme for, you know, for even Stephen King. And then you read them and some of them are, you know, just fairly average pulpy stories. Like I'm thinking of like Road Work here. But then some of them are like The Long Walk, which is in the top like three or four things that King's ever written for me. Like wow. I fucking love that story so much. And Running Man is like got kind of this grit to it. There is a different sense and a different feel with the Bachman things. And so it's weirdly enough, after 4 years of doing the show, we haven't really dove.
It's definitely not Dovin. I can tell you that.
Yeah. We haven't entered into a conversation and palaver about the Bachman Stephen King thing as much as I would have assumed maybe at the start of this, but it really is a fascinating period for King, just kind of releasing this and embracing it, and then of course all this gets even more complicated once he starts, you know, pulling some Rage. Bachman titles out of circulation.
Rage in particular, obviously.
Yeah. So no, do we want to start going through? Because here's the thing, is the Bachman books have been released as two different collections. There's been one where Rage was in it, then one where Rage was pulled and they replaced it with Blaze, right? So yeah, I think we're going to focus on the Rage.
The one I read had Rage in it.
So let's start there. Let's just go through the four Bachman stories.
I did have one thing I wanted to add to what you were saying a second ago, which was, I read some interview where he talked about the death of his mother and how that had created this sort of festering feeling inside of him. And it came out through these stories.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to consider that, because my mom died when I was in my early 20s. And I do remember having like this kind of sense of anger at the time, just that like it was so, so unfair.
Yeah.
And she lost her life. And again, it's not like she was murdered or died in a car. It's like she had cancer. I mean, there's no one to point a finger and say that was unfair too. It felt very unfair. And I had this like very like kind of palpable sense of anger for a period of time afterwards. And so it's interesting. I found it interesting when I heard that fact about him, because I do think that you can feel this sort of anger at the world in all four of the stories, obviously, in Rage. There is,
absolutely. Yes,
there's and a cynicism that runs through.
Is directly tied to his mother's death. I know for sure. You know, and it's, well, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. We'll go through these one at a time.
But you're right. What we're going to reveal as we're going through each of these stories is there is a cynical undercurrent to every single one of them. They're a little grittier. They're a little darker. And that became kind of the identity of Bachman, which is kind of the opposite. Even with King's darkest material, you know, he's a very empathetic writer and generates a lot of empathy, and the Bachman persona doesn't so much, which is really interesting. So let's start with Rage. So Rage, this is the only book, I believe, or the only story that King has ever agreed to let run out of circulation. Mm-hmm. He's not as crazy about it as like George Lucas trying to destroy all the copies of the Star Wars Holiday Special or whatever. You know, he's not trying to erase it out of existence, but he's just not publishing it anymore. And he did that because this is a story about a high school student that shows up to school and with a gun and kills his teacher and then holds his class hostage. And the entire story is told within this classroom as the police and the hostage negotiators and everything are outside. And it's this weird microcosm story where this kid who is obviously the bad kid, you know, bringing guns and killing teachers and whatnot, not great. It becomes a little like Lord of the Flies-ish, where these like little cliques start developing in the classroom. There are people that support him, the people that, you know, are sickened by him, people that are terrified of him. And then like that gradually changes like from person to person. So it's actually a really complex story. But what had happened was there were multiple instances where people, where kids brought either guns to school or like legitimately like did a shooting at a school. And either cited Rage as being their inspiration to do it or had a copy of the Bachman books like in their locker with the story in it. And so King essentially by the late 90s was just like, yep, you know, I'm fine with letting this one fall out of circulation. So what do you think of Rage as a whole, like as a story? And what do you think of like the decision to not keep it in circulation?
Yeah, it's really an interesting conversation, right? Because part of me thinks that once you create a piece of art, you shouldn't change it. You shouldn't take it out of circulation, that it sort of represents a moment in time, not just for the artist, but also for the time and the culture when it was released. And you should certainly approach it with that knowledge and understand that it's representative of a different time in our culture, and certainly a different time in the artist's life. But I do think there is a kind of a threshold where something could cross a line and you could say, you know what, maybe not. Maybe this is something that it should only be really studied by historians or critics or people that really want to do a deep dive. Maybe this shouldn't really be a part of our current pop cultural landscape. And I agree with King. I think the story does cross that line. And I think the line is way, way, way out there. I think you'd be hard pressed to think of other works that truly, truly do that. I mean, like maybe Birth of a Nation. Like we don't
Natural-born killers. Yeah,
we don't need to rent Birth of a Nation, but it should still be available to film historians who want to study it.
Oh, I see. I see. I misunderstood. But the I'm a fucking moron. yeah. But,
and so I'm fine with it not being readily available. I think he made the right choice. I think the story itself, the sort of the Lord of the Flies part that you referenced, I found a little unbelievable. I mean, right. I think he was kind of prescient in sort of predicting how some very disturbed people could act out in this way. But, and so it's grounded in that sense. But I do feel that sort of the way that some of the kids are reacting, you know, the fact that they like put that one kid into a catatonic state, right, is... Hmm. By beating him up. I found that kind of hard to connect to and relate to. So I think more the setup is probably the brilliant part of the story. And I already regret using the word brilliant because it is such a dark and troubled story. I guess the setup
it can be both.
Yeah, the setup is what's intriguing to me. I think the execution kind of falls apart.
I think if I were if I was a creator of whatever the thing is, whether it be a writer or a fucking filmmaker or a painter, you know, whatever the case may be. And on, like, if you look into it, there's at least five separate occasions where there were shootings that very clearly were similar to the shooting depicted in Rage, or the situation depicted there. I can imagine, even though I totally believe that like a work of fiction is not responsible for someone's real world actions. I think that's mental illness. That's not the problem of whoever created the thing. I can easily imagine being like, you know what? I'm done. Get it out of here. Like it's not worth it to like, if this happened once or twice, those are isolated incidents that, you know, millions of people have read this and, you know, it's so fractional that I wouldn't worry about it. But yeah, I think the quote from King was that like, I've had enough, like take it out of circulation. Like, I think I would do that too. It's just, I wouldn't want any of that blood on my hands, you know?
There's two things that you brought up there that I think are interesting that I want to respond to. One is this idea that anything can make anyone do something, like a video game, a book. I didn't even bring that up because I agree with you. I think it's such a ridiculous notion. Like we all need to take responsibility for our own actions. We live in a free society. Blaming a piece of music or a video game
for a mental illness.
Yeah, is not. It just doesn't track for me. Like we all have to, either mental illness or you have to take responsibility for your own actions. The other thing I wanted to respond to that you brought up, which is this idea that it was King who said it, right? This isn't some like group of teetotalers or like a church group that's saying this thing's got to go. This is the guy who created it. And if that's ultimately what he thinks is best, then I think, we should respect his decision.
Yeah. Right on.
And to Scott's point, like the fact that it wasn't a one-off thing, this wasn't like a West Memphis 3 thing where, you know, these kids that were accused of murder happened to have a Stephen King book. You know, these shooters, and I'm looking at it now, and there were six different incidences.
Wow. I didn't know
read the sixth one closer.
Oh, one's cool.
Falsely
compared
reported.
It was compared to Rage. Okay, so where the shooters are literally saying, I was inspired to do this because of this.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine like being an artist having that just on your head, especially somebody as prolific as King, who's just like, for fuck's sake, you know, like I have 60 fucking plus novels. I have probably 1,000 short stories and, you know, a few dozen novellas out there. let's go ahead and take this one out. This, like you said, it's not worth the headache. It's not worth the possibility of inciting another one of these shootings.
It's not worth the weight on your conscience as the creator.
Well, I also firmly believe that if they didn't reference this book as their inspiration, they would have found inspiration elsewhere.
Right? Oh, for sure.
Just to clarify that point, just so you know, no one gets in trouble here. Like, they didn't say that was the inspiration. They did a thing that was extremely similar and then were found to have a copy of it, like, on hand.
At least according to Wikipedia, says that, like, he was directly the friend of the shooter said they were directly inspired.
That might
by
be one. I'm
the
just
Kuwait,
saying,
the
like,
Kuwait Airways I'm, flight hijacking and the novel Rage, which Cox had read over and over and over again.
That's
and
one.
Felt he
that's
said
not
he strongly
all five.
Identified.
I'm getting your back here. Like, yeah. Just let me put it on the record to cover your ass.
I appreciate the point. And yeah. I think the larger point I'm making, though, is that I don't think anyone should even say that, like, by King taking the book out of circulation, that somehow it's going to stop people from behaving. And
it
and,
certainly
and
has.
It has not. Yes. let's
move on to the next story in the book. Eric, you want to trade off? I'll do.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, you love Long Walk. You want to do Long Walk?
Sure, because my memory of road work is very low, so that gives you some time to study up on.
By the way, it's funny. I want to just chime in here.
Yes.
Even though I read all four at the same time, The Long Walk and Running Man loom much larger in my mind than Rage and Road Work.
They're the better stories.
Yeah. Before we even talked about doing this, I had to read the Wikipedia on Road Work because I entirely remember what it was about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I've read Road Work twice at this point, and it's one that just goes in one ear and out the other for me. It's not a bad story. Yeah. It just isn't one that sticks with me. But like The Long Walk, this is, again, top three, four King period all time for me. This is, I think, his first masterpiece. He wrote this when he was in college, which I cannot fucking believe. Just the way the writing is, just the way the characterizations are. It's such a brilliantly drawn world. And so this is kind of like this near future quasi-authoritarian military dictatorship society that we're in. And one of the things that they do to distract the populace, and this has connections to The Running Man, obviously, because it's a similar vibe, is that there's this thing called the Long Walk, where it starts at the Canada main border and goes down I-95 as far as the 100 participants can walk. And the whole conceit is that there can be one winner, and that one winner gets anything that they want. Like, this is, you get to live as a king in this fucked up, crumbling ass world that we're living in. And everybody else will get shot along the way. And so, and it's this great like parable for Vietnam, because it's all about, you know, nobody in this thing is like older than like, you know, draft age, essentially. These are all like, you know, tween to teenagers, you know, late teens. And they have to walk 3 miles per hour, at the very least, which is much faster than you fucking think it is. Try walking 3 miles per hour on a treadmill and seeing how long you can keep that up. Yeah. So they get as they're walking, I don't need to go through the rules and all that shit, but as they're walking, like, relationships form, alliances form. Weirdly enough, this kind of like predicted the reality television thing, right? So you watch any reality television, this is how it always breaks down, whether it's Survivor or any of these random shit, you know, reality shows on Netflix. You know, cliques start to form, alliances start to form. Mm-hmm. These are the bad guys, these are the good guys, but underneath all that, you know that only one person can survive. And so it becomes this slow moving tragedy as the good kids, you know, are starting to die off, and the bad kids are maybe winning, and then they're not. And then I don't know. It's just this wonderful fucking mix of genre, of just deep seated character work against this backdrop of this truly insane, like, all the threat of death is always, you know, always over your shoulder. So this is one of my all time favorites. I've read it, you know, at this point 5 or 6 times, and I'll probably read it another 5 or 6 times before I kick off. You know, it's just one of my favorite fucking things. So there is no question there. That's the background. What is it, Jeff, do you think stuck with you on this one, because you mentioned this one and Running Man being the big sticklers. And Running Man has a movie attached to it that has no real resemblance to the story, but that kept it in pop culture longer. So why? What is it about The Long Walk that has never been adapted, at least up to this point of the recording, kept it in your mind?
Yeah, it must be a hard one to adapt for a variety of reasons. I mean, there's that old adage that good books make bad movies and bad books make good movies.
Right.
Probably is one of the reasons why this one has never been adapted, because it's just
I don't think that's the reason.
Hard to crack. You don't want to see people shooting kids on the street.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I especially don't think you want that movie right now.
Yeah.
That's
It is such a dark, dark story. You know, when times are good, that's when people want to see dark stories in theaters. Mm-hmm. And usually when times are tough, they want the more optimistic fare. Obviously, I'm hoping that's not true.
Yeah, the Obama era. That's when we could have made that movie. Well, it's over.
Times
now.
Are tough right now, and I'm about to put a very dark movie out into the marketplace. So hopefully that's not entirely 100%.
No, I already told you, $100 million.
Where the government itself is like headshotting teenagers in broad daylight. Yeah, it's not.
For getting a Charlie horse and not being able to walk. Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think it spoke to me at the time because the characters were young and they were taking this incredible responsibility on, and they're and being put in such a kind of shocking life or death situation.
Yeah.
You know, I would have to put a little more thought into it, but the whole concept of sort of like the Hunger Games and what was that movie like, Battle Royale or things like that, right? It's like, what was the first version of that story, I wonder? Like, if you started to kind of trace that narrative idea back, where did it first emerge?
Very well might be The Long Walk. There's got to be other...
Or Lord of the Flies.
Well, but Lord of the Flies isn't like a competition show. That's like just a survival.
Yeah, this is
not a competition thing, but like with the cliques forming and the fucking people, you know, kids getting killed off.
Yeah, but I'm speaking more specifically to this idea of kids in a contest.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Kids in a contest with life or death stakes.
Sure.
Is like a balm for society's ails. Right?
You're right.
Like that is a very specific story, but it keeps kind of popping up. And so I just wonder where it first started. I mean, it's just an interesting question.
That's a great,
very
question,
good question. Yeah.
But
a question that I am not smart enough to answer. So
yes.
But The Long Walk is, I think, probably one of the best versions of that story, for all the reasons you guys were just listing, the dynamics within the kids, just sort of the unrelenting feeling when you read it. I mean, you know, when you read a story and it creates a feeling inside of you that is just so palpable, that's when, you know, I think you're reading something very affecting. And I felt like I was on the walk with them.
Yeah.
And it was just so grueling.
Right.
It's true.
It's, yeah. I, you know, we've talked about this a number of times on the show because this property has been up for a movie like on a number of occasions, you know, as recently as a few years ago. And it just never gets over the starting line. And my theory is that no studio in their right mind is going to greenlight this movie. Like it might, you know, the name of Stephen King will attract them to it. The gnarliness of the premise is also attractive, like from a horror standpoint or just a spectacle standpoint. But I don't think when you get right down to it and you're writing a script for this and making a movie out of it, I can't imagine anyone being like, yeah, we're going to put that in theaters. Not right now. Not until something serious.
Well, then why does Squid Games work so well?
Well, first of all, that's not American. That's a Korean thing that is an import, and I think that those guys. We can use battle royales, the same the same touch point, but like, I don't think that like you work in the studio system. How big are the balls on the studio system right now? Because they don't seem very big to me. They seem more like, you know, we're playing it safe because we don't want to get yelled at and we want to make money. and a movie, you put a movie in theaters where teenagers are just getting slaughtered wholesale throughout the entire goddamn thing by their own government, again, in broad daylight, with guns, a thing this country has a huge problem with.
Yeah.
And I don't expect you to address that here on your promotional tour, but like,
we can talk about anything.
Like if you're holding, if it's me and I'm holding the keys to this, to the bankroll, like, I'm like, no, we're not fucking around with this. This is like too big of a headache to deal with right now.
Yeah. Let me be clear. I'm not disagreeing with you. Yeah. I'm just sort of engaging in the debate as a devil's advocate, because I think it's an interesting one to
I think it's if it gets made, it's a streaming thing, and I hope they attach somebody who really brings out the texture of the entire thing and the allegory of it. We've talked about this on the show before. My pet theory is that this is King's response to Vietnam, and I think that you know, someone will eventually do it. But I don't think it's opening on 3,000 screens. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, New Line keeps throwing money at it, though, to hold the rights. So, I mean, they're not doing that because they think they'll never make it.
Right.
You know what I mean? New Line was developing it with Andre Overdahl for years, and that finally fell apart, and it was announced just like 5 or 6 months ago that Francis Lawrence was doing it. So
wasn't Darabont going
to
do it?
He had the rights to it like right around the time he was doing The Mist and all that stuff. You know, that would have been perfect Darabont bleakness, you know.
I know Francis Lawrence is like mounting this thing, but like if I can sit in a theater and watch this movie, I will I don't know. I'm not going to say I would eat a shoe, because that's what what's his name agreed to if they made a Top Gun sequel. Yeah. But I will do something very embarrassing if I can actually go and sit in a theater and watch this movie.
That Francis Lawrence wants to make it, given like he spent so Hunger much of Games. His life making The Hunger Games, right?
Yeah, which
I was Francis Lawrence, I would not want to make that movie.
Well, that's my counter to Scott. You know, Scott's thought that there's just not a market for this, because what is Hunger Games if not
it's you know, putting up
your children and then murdering each other?
Because it's like, dressed up, because the Hunger Games is dressed up in the robes of futurism and, you know, so adventure and all this shit. This is a brutal slog. We are talking about like however many kids it is marching up a highway, highway, like a nondescript fucking like somewhere in Maine, where they're just getting bam, bam, bam shot in the face. Like, I don't know.
And what you're knocking at the door of is something that a professor said to me at USC in film school, which was, you always need to consider kind of the final product that you're creating. You might be the best screenwriter in the world. You might be the best director in the world. And if you're trying to tell a story that makes your audience feel nauseous, great. You know, you made everyone want to throw up. They're not really going to want to tell their friends to go see the movie. Mm-hmm. And so when you describe a story as a brutal slog, it's hard to imagine a studio executive greenlighting it.
I want to be clear. I don't think the story itself is a brutal slog. I think visually it could be.
But
you know,
about,
and there's a way to do
this. Brutal
slog.
It's a movie. You know, it'd be a movie about a brutal slog.
If I don't know, we'll see what happens. I wish it well. Like I wanna sit down. I want to be proven wrong on this.
No.
I just feel like I'll be shocked if it shows up and it looks and feels like a Long Walk movie should. You know, if they, again, if they like bury this under some sort of like Running Man, which we'll talk about in a minute, like a Running Man sort of irony, like they did in the Schwarzenegger movie, I don't think that counts. Like,
I'd agree with there. And also, it wouldn't count if they just cast like fucking 28-year-olds, you know, where it's, you know, a CW cast. You know, the whole impact of this is that it's
teenagers.
It's teenagers. It's the kids who have that fucking kind of feeling of immortality, where they understand what the situation is, but they don't really understand what the situation is, right? Every single one of them is going into this thinking that they're going to be the one making it, and not for a second thinking that that they're going to be the ones dying, which, you know, which is a folly of youth thing. You know, you need, so it's like kind of crucial to the whole theme of this being, you know, how our nation, the military especially, keeps fucking churning, you know, through our
meat grinder. Our youth.
Yeah, it's like, without that part of it, then you're right. Then you're just watching fucking, you know, people getting shot in the head. You know, there is no deeper thing to it. I will agree with you. You don't have to do anything embarrassing if they make it too satirical and they also cast 30-year-olds as right. the people getting shot. Well, look at this. We got a couple of ad reads for you here in the mid-roll. Oh. We have a really great sponsor for the mid-roll this week, and that is Factor, which is America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. We've done a few ad reads for these guys before. They've sent us some goodies. They're delicious. I remember a while back, Factor sent me a bunch of meals. Most of the chicken meals I remember are the ones that stood out to me. So what these things are, they're not like those meal kits where, you know, you have to cook. I like cooking, but a lot of people don't, and I totally understand it. It's time consuming, especially if you're just going out and grabbing all the ingredients yourself, and that's where Factor comes in. They will deliver ready-to-heat meals with the premium ingredients. They don't taste like regular microwavable meals, I swear to you. These things taste like you made them from scratch. The chicken pesto dish is still something I think about. Matter of fact, I should probably put in another order. So if you've got a crazy hectic life, or if you're just lazy like I am, and you don't want to make multiple trips to the grocery store, then try out Factor and you'll get a week's worth of delicious, high quality meals that will be ready to eat after just a few minutes in the microwave. They're healthy too, but they don't often taste like it. You know, I like my veggies drenched in butter, and so do they. So we get along very well. Whatever your diet is, you can have it custom tailored to your tastes. And if all that sounds good, and it should, because I swear these things are delicious, head over to factormeals.com/kingcast50 and use the code kingcast50 when you place your order. Why 50? Well, that's because you get 50% off. That's the KingCast discount, baby. That's KingCast50 at factormeals.com/KingCast50 to get 50% off.
Very well done, Eric.
Thank you.
And I'm here to tell you about Nightmare Fuel, the horror writing course from AutoCrit. If you're hungry to write the next great horror story, but don't know where to start, this comprehensive course will take you on a 4-week journey from the foundations of fear to the final touches that chill to the bone. Described as a must-have in any horror writer's journey, Nightmare Fuel is packed to the brim with creative content, live lessons every week, and more than 15 hours of recorded conversations with modern and historic horror luminaries, including Paul Tremblay, Ramsey Campbell, Joe Kaplan, and many more. All attendees will also gain exclusive access to a live Q&A with publisher Jeff Brown of Cohesion Press. So visit autocrit.com/Fangoria now and get 50% off before class begins on Monday, March 18th. You're guaranteed to have a bloody good time. What do you know about a bloody good time, Eric?
Oh, too much. More than the authorities need to know about, that's for sure. So
very well.
So that sounds good. And it's got the Paul Tremblay seal of approval, which is nice. KingCast,
we love that
guest.
Tremblay.
We love that.
He's
Tremblay.
He's a sweet boy. The sweet boy.
Good old Tremblays. I don't think there's a bad Tremblay out there. Maybe Jacob. We don't know. But
he's an asshole.
Hey,
he killed my grandfather.
I don't know. Okay. We need to get back to the show, but I'm going to investigate this grandfather business a little further when we stop recording. All right, let's get back to the show.
All right. Well, let's move on to Road Work.
Yes.
Road Work is a story about a guy whose son has died. He has fucked up his job at an industrial laundry to a degree that his wife has left him. You know, I imagine, you know, and as you can assume based on this description, like their son's death didn't help. This is a man who's like lost it all, right? And then he finds out that the state wants to they want to install like an off ramp or something to a highway that's essentially going to clear through where he lives and the surrounding areas. So they come in there and they're like, all right, well, eminent domain, we're going to give you X number of dollars to like get the fuck out of here. But, you know, we got to pave all this over. And he's like, fuck that. And this guy, like, he gets involved with like kind of a kind of like a, lo- like a low level, not mob enforcer, but like someone who's like tied into the mob. He's trying to get explosives. That guy blows him off. Well, he sabotages the highway extension at some point once it starts. That's not enough. The guy comes back to him. Long story short, he gets the explosives. He packs his house full of fucking explosives. And then a news crew comes in to interview him and, you know, be like, what's your problem here? And he's just like, fuck all of this. And then then he blows up the house. Mm-hmm. It's about a man at his wit's end. It's sort of like a kind of like a falling down story, you know, if you know that movie.
Yeah,
like,
of course. But, that's a great comp. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, you know, it's a man at his wit's end and he's like rebelling against a local government who you ultimately find out the best part of the story is you find out that like they didn't need to do this. They just needed to keep like building. They needed to keep paving highway in order to get like, I don't know, some sort of funding from the federal government or whatever. But that's basically it. I don't think very much of this story.
No.
It is quintessential Bachman because it's very gritty and it's mostly a crime story.
It has a really random connection to the mafia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like
which thinner. A lot of these Bachman books tend to do. Thinner jumps to mind.
Yeah, well, like all of the Bachman shit is like Donald E. Westlake. You know, it's just like, you know, it's gritty, it's mean-spirited. You know, Jeff, the comparison I usually make is that, like, Richard Bachman is Stephen King, like, dressed up like Snake Plissken, basically. Yes. He's like fucking mad at the world and he's fucking grizzled and blah, blah, blah. Like that's Richard Bachman. That's what this is. I read this story once and was like, I get it. Fine. You know, Jeff, your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny that a storyteller's relationship with their audience, right? Like I'm just sitting here listening to you guys talking about it and I'm so aware of what my audience thinks and feels. Like, I mean, we do test screenings and we're like manipulating little cuts and shots and trying to get the exact response we want to get from our audience. Right. Whereas Stephen King as Richard Bachman doesn't really seem to give a fuck, right? Like it is this outlet for him of these really dark, unpleasant feelings he's having. And I both sort of admire it now that I'm thinking about it through this lens, but also part of me, I guess admire is the wrong word. I'm jealous of him, you know, that he can write stories and put things out there in the world and not really care about how it's received. But also at the same time, and obviously the guy is a genius and a master at his craft. So I feel even weird challenging any aspect of his process or his career. So please forgive me. I'm very aware of my
peon status. It's fine. It's fine to be critical of King. And especially at this age, like he wrote this thing when he was so young. You know?
I wonder if he's kind of missing a little bit of the joy of storytelling on such a mass scale, right? That you consider the meaning that the audience is going to make when they perceive your story through the filter of their own experience. And I wonder if the meaning that some readers made when they first read these books was just like, yeah, you know, I'm pissed too. And I'm getting screwed over and I'm going to lose in the end also. So
I don't think you're wrong. I think like Bachman as a persona is mostly about Stephen King being pissed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, that's kind of an interesting thing. And it's an interesting thing in the sense that you know, some of this is motivated by his mother's death. Mm-hmm. It's interesting in that he didn't feel like he could incorporate that anger into the other stuff he was writing. Like there was a point where he felt like he had to create this thing in order to get this out of his system.
Well, and he had to hide behind someone else.
Yeah,
he had to create this and other person.
That's wild.
Yeah. He probably didn't have the stomach to put it out as himself, not from purely like a crass kind of marketing standpoint, but there were probably was some part of him that was a little bit embarrassed. Like, I guess I could relate to it in the sense that I wrote a script once years and years and years ago. And it was actually kind of, no, I had already made Cry Wolf, but it was very early in my career. And I wanted to write another scary movie, a supernatural scary movie. And I had this idea about a town where SIDS was happening at like a rate 1,000 times higher than anywhere else in the US. God. Right? And the local doctor starts to figure it out.
The nuclear long walk.
It's super dark. Super dark. The local doctor starts to figure it out, and everyone starts becoming suspicious of him. He's like, well, if all these kids are dying, maybe the common denominator is you. And there's ultimately like a supernatural explanation. I'm kind of riffing on the Pied Piper, but I finished it and I've never shown it to anyone. Because as soon as I finished it, I had this epiphany. I was like, oh, I just wrote the dead baby movie.
100%.
Nobody's going to see that or make that. I'm an idiot.
And you're so like, we're going to need a budget about, you know, a solid $3 million for all the dead baby animatronics we're going to need for this.
So I wonder if, you know, King, when
not animatronics. I'm sorry to interrupt, but not animatronics, because I suppose they wouldn't be moving, but at least dead baby puppets.
Listen, I'm trying. I tried to walk right up to the dead baby line and then walk back as quickly as possible. If you want to sit there and just look over the edge and talk about dead baby animatronics, we can do that too.
Haven't we all walked up to the dead baby line at some point in our lives?
Amy Boyle has done dead baby animatronics. If you've seen,
that's true.
That's on the ceiling. Yes.
Good times. Good times.
Yeah.
My point being that that clearly he wrote this and he didn't know what to do with it, because in many ways the Bachman books are his dead baby movie, and he wanted to get it out into the world, but he didn't want to do it as King. Have you guys read anything where he's talked about how he came to the conclusion that he was going to use a pen name to publish these books?
Yeah. He's gone on the record, and his story, the story changes a little bit over the years. There's like the, just the realistic angle, not the creative angle, where he's just like, listen, I had all these stories, and he was so prolific that he never was hurting for another, for like, oh shit, I have a hole to fill in the schedule. He was always just writing, and he wanted an outlet for some of these other stories, but his publishers were like, you cannot publish two books a year, because then people will get fed up with you, and you know, you're going to wear out your welcome, blah 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 blah, you're going to overexpose yourself, was their logic. And so he then said, well, how about I release them under a different name? And then he like the origin story evolved into, I'm doing this because I wanted to see if it was my name that was moving these books or the quality of the material. Right. And then I think then that even changed like a little bit later on down the line, because it, I mean, just, we have eyeballs and we see that like this is such a radically different voice. You know, I think that Long Walk could very feasibly fall into, say, like a Different Seasons kind of novella, you know, thing. But pretty much everything else is as we said, has got that fucking dark undertone, you know?
Yeah.
It depends when you read what he said. That's basically the origin of Bachman. And then he got found out because of a copyright thing that was claimed, whereas like his King's like lawyer or something was named and, you know, as a copyright holder or something. And so somebody figured it out. But one thing I wanted to say about Roadwork before we move on to the next one is that thing you were talking about with him saying that his mother's death like inspired it, like that's directly for Roadwork, where, you know, there's this like guy dealing with all these feelings and then feeling like everything was out of his control, and he's trying to regain some sort of control and dealing with the anger of his son dying and his wife leaving and all this stuff. So that was directly involved. But the thing that I saw, you know, doing my little bit of due diligence before we started recording, was that initially with the initial publication of the Bachman books, he essentially had stated, he's like, this story, Roadwork, not my favorite. It's matter of fact, I debated even putting it in here, but what the hell, you know, at least this is something for the readers to know what I, you know, where my mind was creatively at this point. Right.
Interesting.
And then in the recent Bachman books, he said, you know what, actually the story's grown on me. I think it's my favorite of the Bachman books.
Yeah. That's
which
true.
Is really fucking interesting to me how, you know, how he can one make that turn. And also what, like the King's, what Stephen King himself says are his favorite stories are always so wildly different than what you'd think. Like Lisi's story is his favorite novel that he's ever written. Right. And so it's interesting. Like, I just wonder what plays into that. Is it just because he's proud of individual work, sentence structure, you know, the craft of it? Or is it like, this is me getting all my emotions out and it's as authentically me as it could possibly be? Or is it like some contrarian thing that he has where it's just like, this is the one nobody likes, so I'm going to say I like this one.
You know? Or I would offer another explanation. Maybe it's the one that surprises him. You know,
could be.
I hate looking at my movies because by the time you finish the film, as a director, all you're doing is trying to solve problems every phase. And especially as you get towards the end in post with like ADR lines and reframing shots and color timing, you're just trying to fix everything that you think is wrong. And then when you get to the end of that process, you basically have to just admit there's all this stuff that's wrong and I just don't have the ability, the resources, or the time to fix it. So I just have to walk away. There's like a George, was it, was it Francis Ford Coppola, I think, said this, you don't finish a film, you abandon it, right?
Yeah.
And so I hate looking at my movies because all I do is see the mistakes that I couldn't fix. Yeah.
And you're not alone. Everybody does that. Spielberg says, like, I think he said Raiders of the Lost Ark is the only movie that he, of his, that he can watch and disassociate himself from it. But everything else he's made, all he sees is his failure. Yeah.
But recently I rewatched my second movie that I made in 2008. So, you know, we're talking about, it's probably 15 years ago. I probably watched it last year. So 15 years later, I looked at it and I had a different experience for the first time, which was that I felt like I was having a conversation with a younger version of myself. Mm. And I was like, oh, look at that. Oh, you were a real dummy for thinking that was a good idea. Or, oh, look, wow, that's interesting. I was really audacious. I would probably be too nervous to try that now. Look at me. I was kind of brave and bold in this choice. So I wonder if he has that experience too. Like when he's reading some of these books, it's a chance to sort of talk to the a younger version of himself, and maybe he gets surprised by some of the choices he made.
Maybe.
I'm glad that you brought up your 2008 film, your feature, Never Back Down.
Are you?
Because I would like to ask you a question, and yes, this will, please. Like, I need this fucking information, man. How do you pronounce the name of... I don't want to say it because I don't want to fucking mangle
it's,
it.
It's
but...
Amber Heard. Amber Heard.
Jimon Hounsou is my guess.
Jimon Hounsou.
Jimon Hounsou.
Jimon Hounsou.
Okay. I've been typing that name for, you know, I worked in the content blogging minds for many years, and I've been typing it, but did not know how to pronounce it.
So many people say Digimon, which is so wrong.
Jesus
Christ. So wrong.
That's like not racist, but also feels racist. You know,
or
what I
like
mean?
A Pokemon character.
Digimon is a thing.
It's an off-brand Pokemon.
Yeah,
is it?
Like that's it's like we have Pokemon at home.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah.
By the way, Digimon. When you first started asking me that question, I actually thought you were going to ask about Cam Gigande, who plays the villain, who has an equally difficult name to pronounce.
And that's I thought his name was
Cam Gigante.
Nope, Gigande. Oh,
well, there you go.
All right. Well,
it's
now
pronounced
I know.
Bachman.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, let's move on to The Running Man. This is the final novella in this story, in this book, in
collection.
This novel. Like they're novellas, right, Vespi?
I don't know. I've always been so vague on what that is. I think it has to do with page count is in word count, maybe.
Fucking
is a novella, but
shit.
But
I don't
like
deal
these
with
were
that.
Released as their own individual books, but they were like paperback pulp. All like right. Short pulp novels. So,
yeah, like Running Man's 200 pages. That's a novella to me.
Interesting.
All right. I just Googled novella.
Yeah. Okay.
And the definition is a short novel or long short story. So,
okay. Does it have a page count attached?
Nope.
Fucking horseshit. We're just making things up.
That was, by the way, the most non-definition I think you could have imagined. A short novel or long short story.
Yeah, exactly.
What is a novella?
Yes.
It's a novella.
Yes.
Yeah. Next.
It is either vanilla chocolate or chocolate vanilla. Yes, thank you. The Running Man, I almost feel like this needs no introduction. We have covered The Running Man, the movie, a number of times on this show. So much that we have like retired it for a long time. In fact, I think we could get away with doing another Running Man episode again sometime soon.
Yeah, enough time has passed. For
yeah,
sure.
But this is a movie about, excuse me, this is a story about a guy, Ben Richards, who in the future He lives in a world where the government has sort of insinuated itself into the entertainment industry, and they have an entire network where they run these shows that are like hyper violent and involve people, you know, like being killed. Ben Richards submits himself to the whims of this entertainment network that runs a show called The Running Man, right? He tries out just to be on the network. They let him on the network. They place him with The Running Man, and here's the gist. He has to evade capture, or, well, not capture. He has to avoid getting killed by the hunters that they're sending after him, like, all over the fucking world. The movie is not like this. And he has to send in two, like, little video messages a day to the network so they can air those as part of their programming. And this guy has to go on the run. He has to avoid any narcs, because the entire populace has been weaponized against him. They get paid if he gets caught or killed. So he has to evade capture or getting killed, keep himself a secret, and then, well, it ultimately gets down to Ben Richards having kind of gotten the upper hand on him up until he is in a plane flying towards the high rise skyscraper that is the network's like main office. And he plows this fucking plane into the building as a final act of like, fuck you, I'm out. Jeff, what do you think? What do you think about this story? And I mean, the grittiness, specifically I'm interested in your opinion of the grittiness and like the, I don't know, how do I say it? The realism of the story versus what they did with the Schwarzenegger version of the story.
Yeah. I mean, I love the idea of sort of a state sanctioned deadliest game, dangerous game. Isn't that what the short story is called? The most dangerous game?
The most dangerous game. Yes. Yeah.
I love the idea of like a state sanctioned version of that. I think that's a really fascinating idea. And it's interesting to talk about The Running Man in contrast to The Long Walk, because they have similarities, but they also have some distinct differences. And I think The Running Man probably resonates more with a larger audience because of the main difference, which is you have a character who's kind of fighting back, right? That seems to have at least a chance. To, you know, win this contest or rail against the powers that be. It's interesting that it ends with this sort of final act of suicide. I think I responded to it because it just felt a little bit bigger than The Longest Walk. I mean, I love The Longest Walk. Don't get me wrong. Longest Walk and Running Man are my two favorite of the four.
Well, it's global versus...
Yeah, it just felt bigger. It feels like probably it was the little movie maker in me starting to rear his head. That it just felt like a bigger story. Like I could feel the appeal of the story.
Right.
And I think, you know, game shows kind of, what was it called? The Game Network? What was the Games
the Games
Network. Game Show Network. Game Show Network.
Yeah. So, I mean, that kind of was a real crunchy idea for me that I got excited about. It's funny too, having seen the Schwarzenegger movie, how they sort of parts of the story in the movie kind of blend together a little bit in my mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it was interesting to reconsider just the story before this podcast. I would love to have been involved in the development of the Schwarzenegger movie. I mean, how did they decide to make some of these changes from the story to the film script? Like, where did they come from? What was the impetus? I mean, have you guys done a deep dive on the film itself?
Not like, I don't know, like,
well, yeah,
investigative, but we definitely have to, you know, coin the phrase, 80s long ass while observing the film. Yes. And how there's, everybody in the 80s, their clothing accentuated long butts. To what you are getting at, I think so much of that just came from Schwarzenegger being the guy that got the money. Right. And then Schwarzenegger came on and he just wanted to he had his guy who had just written Commando, I think, for him, came in. There was a director that was on board that got fired after the first week, and the replacement came on, and he was like a TV director and essentially was just trying to get the thing over the finish line. And so it was a troubled production that was essentially driven by Schwarzenegger's star power and his desire to shape the movie around him to be more of a Schwarzenegger action vehicle.
Yeah,
right?
It's funny. I'd forgotten that D'Souza, who wrote Commando, has a writing credit on it. And that sort of action movie one-liner quippy thing was really his stock and trade. And so now it does make sense.
And there's some clunkers in there, but man, I fucking love Running Man. And like, the movie was something that I enjoyed as a kid. And I just figured, oh, I like stupid shit as a kid. But the more we rewatch it for the show, I'm like, this isn't at RoboCop levels, but it's just underneath RoboCop. Like, the satire is so fucking right on. The whole casting Richard Dawson as the host.
Amazing.
You know, I mean, everything, like, I don't want to go over the same ground that we've gone over in previous episodes on this, but like, I'm surprised at how smart and sharp the satire is in this every time I revisit it, and how, like, you know, prescient it ended up being. What I love though about the story that they only touch upon in the movie, and I'm hoping is kind of a centerpiece if Edgar Wright ever gets his version of this movie off the ground. I love how it makes the audience complicit in a way that The Long Walk doesn't, right? Where
the
people gathering around watching those kids walk in The Long Walk, they're trying to offer them help, and they're shocked. They're kind of there to see blood, but they at least feign like, oh my God, somebody got shot in front of me, and they gasp, and it's a horror thing, and they're kind of confronted by that. What they do in The Running Man is, as Scott said, and when he was describing the plot, they make them complicit. Matter of fact, they reward them. If you narc on them, if you see Ben Richards out and about, you know, you give us a call to 1-800 blah 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 blah, and if, you know, if that tip off is real, then guess what, you and your family get 1,000 future bucks or whatever the fuck. And the whole world is so fucked, and everybody is so desperate that, you know, it just turns into you know, kind of this surveillance state in a weird way, you know, where everybody's just looking for an opportunity to narc. And I don't know, there's just this whole, you're complicit in all this, you know, as an audience member, that the movie touches on, but then, like, you know, it kind of goes in a more, I don't know, hopeful way, you know, when you have like the granny that starts betting on Ben Richards in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. When he's like, I'm betting on Ben Richards. Like, no, you have to pick a hunter that's going to kill him. He's like, no, Ben Richards is going to kill him. He's a bad motherfucker or whatever, you know? The movie kind of cops out on that aspect a little bit. And I really love that in the book. You know, it's very cynical, and everybody's, even the nice people are going to ultimately be looking after their own interests, and they'll fuck you over. But, I don't know. There's just something, you know, really refreshing to read a story like that, where it's like, yep, even the good people that are on hard times are going to be thinking about themselves.
Well, it does make itself more of a story that you would want to see a film adaptation of, right? So,
right.
You know, The Long Walk, I think you'd be hard pressed to say the world changes. Like, it's sort of the theme of The Long Walk is that it just keeps going, right? Isn't the last line, we still more walking to do.
Oh yeah. Like. Yeah. It's still going. Yeah.
It just keeps going. Whereas to your point about the people who start betting on Ben Richards, you're saying, no, this guy has changed the world in which he lives to a certain degree. And that is a Hollywood message, right? That the individual can affect real change in the larger world around them.
Yeah. There's a little bit of they live in the DNA here, which is interesting because obviously the Running Man, I think, was published well before They Live existed. But, you know, it's a similar thing because, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, isn't the building that he flies the plane into, isn't that like the satellite that's like beaming the fucking show out to everybody and stuff?
It's like the epicenter of their operation.
Right.
Yeah. It's like crushing
the
thing itself.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like the literal satellite that's beaming the show out. So by his thought process is destroy this, destroy the show. You know, maybe the populace wakes up. Right. Which is exactly what, you know, they live. The message is there, which again is another very fucking super cynical movie and story.
I would like to add here that
yes.
I was, you know, looking into The Running Man again today, and I found, like, I turned up a news article from some years ago, whenever they announced the new Edgar Wright version.
Yeah.
That promised it would be more promised in the trades. said, mm-hmm. claimed, alleged that it would be closer to the original text. Like, this would be a more faithful adaptation. I can imagine Edgar Wright doing something in between the Running Man movie and the novella. I can't imagine him doing a straight up version of this. It's too dark and there's zero humor in it. Like, there's gotta be some sort of middle ground going on here. And I also think from the standpoint of whatever studio is fucking attached to this thing, I think they're going to want him to be like, if you're going to remake The Running Man, like, there's gotta be some more satirical, more obviously, I should say, satirical elements to it. And that's what I would expect from
it. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah.
I do not think, I'm a huge Edgar Wright fan. I can't imagine his take is going to be moving back towards the novella. Like, I might get rid of some of the cheesy humor from the movie, but the sort of the over the top satirical elements of the movie seem right up his alley. I mean, he has such a great dry wit, you know.
My guess is that it will be more global than the original Running Man, which was like they shoot Schwarzenegger like down a tube into like a series of dungeons, basically like Zelda dungeons or something to fight the hunters. I don't think that's what it'll be. I think it'll be more of a, you know, crisscrossing the globe sort of thing.
Yeah, he'll be on the
run. It'll adopt that. And I think it'll be like maybe a little bit more mean spirited or something, but you know, I'm speculating, but I think it will retain the satirical elements and the, and specifically the over-the-top satirical elements that mark that movie. Otherwise, I don't know why fucking Edgar Wright would want to do it. I
agree. Yeah, I mean, Edgar himself has spoken about this in the last couple of years, where he claims that he's wanting to go back to the novella, and so, I mean, we'll see. I mean, the writer on it is Michael Bacall, who's fucking great, by the way, but he's more known for 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. You know, which has
those are pretty broad movies.
Those are pretty broad, you know, and play into the comedy. So, you know, who knows? But, you know, I don't see redoing. I mean, I guess there's a lot of fertile ground and satire for, you know, kind of megalomaniacs and, you know, are the sportsification of everything in our, you know, world where everybody's either on your team or against you and somebody you have to beat. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's still some rich ground there, but I just, you know, maybe it's there's the reason why it hasn't happened. I don't know, but I just can't imagine he would just want to go back and do like a modern Schwarzenegger version of the story.
Well, I will say anything Edgar Wright does, I am excited to see. So,
of course.
It will be interesting to see which way he takes it.
Yeah, I'd just love to see him do King. Yeah,
I hope it still gets made, and I think that, like, we talked to Joe Cornish within the last year, who's like a frequent collaborator of Wright's, and I remember, like, during that conversation, like, I don't know if it was on air or like after we got off, but like we brought up The Running Man, and he's like, "I've got the script sitting here in front of me right now."
Wow,
and I was like, "Wow, holy fucking shit!" That's like, cool. So, like, I know there's a script.
Yeah.
I hope they make this movie. But it's been so long since we heard anything about it that I'm kind of like, is this thing still happening or is this another long walk? Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so we'll see. But I'm hopeful. I would love to see Edgar Wright's The Running Man in a theater, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
But Jeff, we have run out of time with you. Unfortunately, you picked a collection of four stories.
Yes. We did four podcasts. In one.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think we've more or less covered it, and you have more than acquitted yourself, but this is usually the point in the show where we turn over the mic to our guest and let them promote what they were here to promote in the first place and where to find you online or any of that shit. Like it's self promo corner time. Tell the people.
I will keep it brief. Got a movie in theaters, March 8th, Imaginary. Please check it out. Please see it in theaters. Got to keep the theatrical experience alive for more than just massive superhero movies. So I would be so grateful if you're at all interested. See it in theaters, March 8th. And yeah, I'm on Instagram at Jeff Wadlow. Love communicating with people who like my work. Love hearing about other people's work. So feel free to reach out.
Do you like communicating with people that don't like your work?
I mean, listen, they definitely like communicating with me.
that was the correct answer. Yes.
I appreciate any and all criticism. But yeah.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. But like you were great. This was great. We can't wait to see Imaginary. We encourage all of our listeners to check it out when it hits theaters. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Many thanks to Jeff Wadlow for joining us. He quickly became a favorite guest, I think it's safe to say.
I like that guy. I don't always love the movies he makes, but I like that guy a lot. And I'm very excited to see Imaginary.
Yeah. Big same. It's definitely one that's on the calendar. As a matter of fact, I think we booked, Kels and I booked tickets to see it Thursday night, you know, because right before South by Southwest, that's what I want to do is watch yet another movie, but we're making room because it looks good enough. Do you want to tell the people what we got coming up next week on the main feed?
Yes. We have a film critic, a cultural critic.
A luminary, you might say.
A luminary. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Very good. By the name of Jeff Zhang, who is coming on to talk about 1408, a movie that I think we've only covered like once or twice on the show.
Yeah, and one of the better Stephen King adaptations, a great short story and a really solid movie. Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of our top however many, if you listen to our Screen Draft episodes, however many that was, King movie. We have a whole conversation about 1408. We still have not got John Cusack on the show. We're trying very hard.
Yeah, but we're taking baby steps. He has followed the KingCast Twitter account and still follows,
yes,
but is not answering DMs. That is that we just pulled the curtain back, Oz style, the great Oz style.
Yeah,
we're on our booking process.
We're working on this. If you are listening to this, normally I'm like, don't tag people that you want on the show, but maybe tag John Cusack. Tell him you want him on the KingCast. Let's see what happens.
But make it sound organic. Like, don't tell him that we sent you, you know, because
right,
that's kind of
right.
Gauche. So, you know, we trust you guys to pester in the correct way. So
it would complete my life at John Cusack if you appeared on the KingCast. Like that exactly. Kind of thing.
We swear we won't ask about the beanie.
Or the vapes.
All right, so we got that coming on the main feed next Wednesday, and this Friday, as always, we have a bonus episode of the show, full length, ad-free bonus episode that will be on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up, send us a few bucks. And our bonus episode this week is the continuing adventures of Bug, Crystal, and Bruce as we hit episode 8 of season 2 of Shelbyville.
Closing in on that.
I know, we're getting into the back third now. And if you've been following along with this actual play story, I'm here to tell you things are getting really intense and emotional. It got emotional for us playing it. And we're like, oh, holy shit, we actually like are really super invested in this. We're getting to the conclusion of the season now. Everything's in motion. We are in the end game now, as Doctor Strange might say.
We are in fact to a point with it where I feel like people who are not signed up to the KingCast Patreon, I feel bad for them. I feel like their lives are less fulfilled than mine is, or yours, or anyone else who is listening.
There's definitely an empty spot in their hearts, and if we're speaking directly to you and you're feeling this, that means you got to throw us some money over at Patreon and fill that gaping hole in your heart with the wondrousness of Shelbyville. So we got that. We got commentaries, interviews, a whole backlog. We're going on 3-ish plus years, I think, at this point of Patreon bonus episodes full length. So if you're only listening to the main feed, you're only getting half the show. Sign up, throw us a few bucks, and we'll make it worth your while. So. Yes. I think that's it. I guess we'll see y'all in the main feed next week with Jeff Zhang for 1408, and this Friday, the continuing season 2 of Shelbyville.
Adios, folks.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.